From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, a chapter in the war on drugs about power, greed, terrorism, and U.S. intelligence. We talk with Mark Bowden about his new book, Killing Pablo, the story of Pablo Escobar, the head of Colombia's Medellin cocaine cartel. We'll hear about how he rose from local gangster to international drug trafficker and the role U.S. intelligence agencies played in hunting him and killing him. Also, book critic Maureen Corrigan reviews Women's Tales from the New Mexico WPA, a collection of interviews conducted during the Depression as part of the Federal Writers Project. They're published for the first time now. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. The Pentagon has withdrawn an order from Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld that would have suspended all U.S. military ties with China. Rear Admiral Craig Quigley, a spokesman for Rumsfeld, said the memo calling for the suspension was written by an aide who misinterpreted the secretary's intentions. Quigley said Rumsfeld's actual intention was for all parts of the military contacts program to be reviewed and approved on a case-by-case basis. Quigley wouldn't name the aide who wrote the memo, but he said that Rumsfeld didn't see it before it was sent to senior military and civilian officials at the Pentagon. Senate GOP leaders say they've worked out a compromise budget agreement with the House. It entails more spending and a smaller tax cut than what the House had earlier approved. NPR's David Wellner reports from the Capitol.
Senate Majority Leader Trent Lott says he's confident there will be what he calls substantial bipartisan support in the Senate for the budget agreement. The deal worked out with centrist senators shrinks the $1.6 trillion tax cut proposed by the president to $1.35 trillion. That figure includes a $100 billion tax cut aimed at stimulating the economy this year. And the chairman of the Senate Budget Committee, Pete Domenici, says there's also a deal now on spending levels for the budget, which is for the fiscal year beginning in October. It raises spending levels from the 4% increase called for by the president and approved by the House to an increase of 4.998%. The Senate had earlier approved boosting spending by 8% next year. Both the House and the Senate have yet to approve the budget deal. They're expected to do so this week. David Wellner, NPR News, the Capitol.
President Bush has set up a commission to look into privatizing part of the Social Security system. The president said today that the current system will leave younger workers with only a small return on their investment. President Bush's plan to go ahead with a national missile defense system has drawn a reaction from Moscow. The BBC's Jackie Rowland reports Russian leaders see this as an abrogation of the landmark 1972 anti-ballistic missile treaty.
Mr. Ivanov's response to the American president's speech was firm but diplomatic. He made it clear that Moscow considered the ABM treaty to be the keystone of subsequent arms control agreements. That's why we're so determined to keep and strengthen the treaty, he said at a news conference. But Mr. Ivanov said Russia was ready for consultations, and he looked forward to explaining Moscow's position at a future meeting with American officials. Like Western governments, the authorities in Moscow appear to realize that President Bush's decision to pull out of the ABM treaty is irreversible. The best that Moscow can do now is to put a brave face on the inevitable.
The BBC's Jackie Rowland. In stocks today, the Dow lost 21 points to close at 10,876. The Nasdaq gained 52 points. This is the NPR News. The Joint Commission on Accreditation of Healthcare Organizations reports an increase in the number of cases of jaundice among newborns. It calls on hospitals to take greater precautions. NPR's Patricia Naiman has more.
All newborns are at risk for jaundice because it takes a few days for the liver to be fully functional. Jaundice develops when the liver is not properly excreting toxins. It causes the skin to yellow, and when not treated, it can cause brain damage. Jaundice is easily treated once identified, but it can take days to become apparent, and by then, infants are often already at home. In an alert sent to the nation's 5,000 hospitals, officials with the accreditation organization warn against sending infants home too soon and call on hospitals to implement a number of cautionary measures, including routine follow-up of newborns 2 days after they're sent home, along with providing parents educational materials to identify symptoms of jaundice. Patricia Nament, NPR News, Los Angeles.
A federal grand jury in Washington has indicted the former chairman of two of the world's largest auction houses on price-fixing charges. The Justice Department said Alfred Taubman, the former head of Sotheby's, and Anthony Tennant, the former chief of Christie's, have been charged with conspiring to fix the commission rates they charge to sellers. The indictment accuses the two men of working together to keep commission rates high over a six-year period in the United States and abroad. The law they're accused of violating carries a maximum penalty of 3 years in prison and a $350,000 fine. In stocks, the S&P 500 gained about a point to close at 1,267. Corey Flintoff, NPR News, Washington.
Support for NPR comes from Sodexo Marriott Services, providing customized approaches to food and facilities management services throughout North America, on the web at SodexoMarriott.com.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. As head of Colombia's Medellin cocaine cartel, in the 1980s, Pablo Escobar was one of the richest men in the world and one of its most infamous criminals. My guest, Mark Bowden, is the author of the new book, Killing Pablo. It's the story of Escobar's rise from local gangster to cocaine kingpin and how the U.S. military and intelligence agencies helped find and kill him in 1993. Bowden's previous book was the bestseller Black Hawk Down, about one firefight during the American mission in Somalia in 1993. It's currently being made into a movie directed by Ridley Scott. Mark Bowden has reported for the Philadelphia Inquirer for over 20 years. Pablo Escobar terrorized his opposition with the help of an army of gunmen. I asked Bowden how this street thug became a drug lord.
The cocaine business in Colombia in the early 1980s, and actually probably the mid-1970s when it started switching over from marijuana to cocaine, was primarily the illicit business of well-to-do young Colombians, not career criminal types, but just, you know, young men who had the means and the connections in Miami to bring the drug up and peddle it. When they started making a lot of money, Pablo Escobar moved in. Now, Pablo was a legitimate street thug. I mean, he'd be like somebody from South Philadelphia who was, you know, had family ties or something to the mob. And he was not known for his finesse. He was a violent man, and he would have people killed. And I think they knew that he would have them killed. And that made people respect him and fear him.
What was the Medellin cartel's violence like at its peak?
At its peak, the cartel was killing people wholesale. I mean, I think I've never, you know, tried to figure out what it was per day, but they used violence as their main means of negotiation and on a business level, and they were killing anyone in the country who spoke out against them, journalists who initiated prosecution against them, that would be judges or prosecutors, who pursued or arrested someone who made trouble for the cartel. They would kill the policemen. There were so many policemen being killed by the cartel gunmen by the mid, let's say, by around 1988, 1989, that the government of Colombia built a special funeral chapel in Bogota to handle all of the funerals. There were so many.
Now, you say that Pablo Escobar was a gangster, not a businessman. But did the cartel create any new business approaches to distributing cocaine?
Well, they definitely did. You know, Pablo Escobar, in part because he was so feared, intimidated anybody who was making money in the business to come under his umbrella. He wasn't involved in growing the cocaine himself or processing it. What his genius was coordinating all of the manufacturing efforts and the distribution efforts and putting them all basically on the same track. He was primarily a smuggler. You know, I think he made most of his money because he could get such vast amounts of the cocaine out of Colombia and into the United States. He had everything from little submarines to aircraft to boats to people who would carry it over, you know, across the borders. And anyone who was making money on their own eventually would have to either join up with Pablo Escobar or he would take over from them. He would force them out of the business.
Was he liberal at bribing people?
Pablo was always ready to offer a bribe. And, you know, with the bribe came a threat. You know, he had such a reputation that the expression was that you could accept Pablo's lead or his silver. And he would give you that option. And, that went for people who were in the drug business as well as politicians and legislators and judges and even journalists.
How did Pablo Escobar make his reputation as a criminal and gangster before he became involved in selling cocaine?
Well, he dropped out of school when he was about 16 or 17 and formed with some of his friends a gang that initially just hustled money from people on the streets, conned people out of money, but eventually got into the business of stealing car parts. And they got to be so successful at that, eventually they were stealing whole cars, and eventually they were just basically stealing the cars directly from the manufacturers. And then Pablo got into the business of basically insuring cars from theft, which is a tricky way of controlling both sides of it. So you could pay Pablo not to steal your car, or you could have your car stolen.
Why did he get into the cocaine business?
I think he got into the cocaine business because it was so incredibly lucrative. He saw how much money was being made. I mean, the amounts of money being made from the marijuana period, which was during the late 60s and the 70s, which was substantial in Colombia, probably increased 100-fold almost overnight when the big demand for cocaine started in the United States. So Pablo was just in a position to muscle into that business and organize it and basically have everybody working for him and control those trade routes. That was the thing that he really, I think, brought to the equation. And he would essentially sort of buy the product from whoever was making it and transport it, and he would keep the lion's share of the money for himself. But everybody was getting rich off of it, not just Pablo.
You say that Pablo Escobar had always been a big marijuana smoker. Did he ever become a cocaine user?
Well, from everything I've heard, Pablo was not a big cocaine user, nor was he a big drinker. He was a doper all of his life. He used to start smoking late in the afternoon and basically stay high. And that was just his way of dealing. And he slept from, 3 or 4 o'clock in the morning until mid-afternoon, and he would get up and light up.
Okay. I guess that didn't affect his taste for violence.
No.
Or if anything, it just increased it.
Well, maybe some people think that marijuana makes you more mellow and peace-loving, but Pablo was raised in a culture of violence that has deep roots in Colombia. And all through the period of his early years, there was this terrible wrenching experience that they referred to in Colombia simply as La Violencia. And this was a time of intense, sort of chaotic civil war where right-wingers were fighting against left-wingers and left-wingers were intimidating the peasants and bandits were roaming the countryside stealing from everybody and the government didn't really have any control. And I think that the climate that Escobar came up in was one of if you had anything of value, you needed to protect it. And if you wanted to be feared, you had to be more violent than the next person. So to him, I think he wrote something once about how did people expect that the government was going to protect them from thieves. And this government in Colombia doesn't protect anybody from anything. So you have to learn to protect yourself. And especially since he got into, illegal business, I think it was incumbent on him to be ruthless and violent, or he never would have been successful.
What was the public image of Pablo Escobar when the Medellin cocaine cartel was at its peak? The public image in Colombia?
Pablo Escobar was a very, very popular figure, particularly in Medellin, but throughout the country of Colombia for a while. He was elected to Congress as an alternate and was really regarded as a threat by the political powers in Bogota because they saw that he had this enormous popular support. He was seen as a Robin Hood on an international scale. He was someone who funneled American dollars into Colombia and got a lot of Colombians rich, including, some of the most established legitimate families in Bogota who would invest in Pablo's cocaine shipments disguised as some sort of a legitimate, inoffensive thing, but everybody knew what it was. It was just sort of an open secret in Colombia. So they could invest their money in some deal that was given some legitimate pretense, and you know, their money would be increased tenfold if that particular shipment went through. So he had deep and wide popularity in Colombia. He was popular both to left-wing people and to right-wing people because he was a capitalist. He was someone who had succeeded brilliantly, you know, in a sort of raw capitalistic scale. And he was popular with the leftists because he spent some of his vast fortune on building housing in the slums in Medellin, which were just terrible places, giving people really for the first time in their lives a place to live. Built schools, built hospitals, built soccer fields and lights on the soccer fields so that workers could play at night. There are still people in Medellin who have his picture in frames on their walls and who burn candles to him. They regard him as an almost saintly figure.
Did you come to see him as an ambiguous figure?
I did. My personal opinion is that I think that Escobar had a bit of a social conscience, but it was a calculated kind of social conscience. I think he wanted to be loved because being loved made him more powerful. And I think down deep, you know, he really wanted to be the president of Colombia. He wanted to be a great man. And he was never able to pull that off because the respected families in Colombia, basically the power elite in Bogota, were embarrassed by him and, you know, realized that they could not allow this most notorious cocaine trafficker in the world to become the president of Colombia or become a significant political power. So they had to slap him down.
Just as he used charity and good social causes for self-serving reasons, did he also use political rhetoric for self-serving reasons?
Oh, that even more so. Pablo, at the same time that he was the primary financial backer for these right-wing paramilitary squads who would go out and assassinate whole villages of people who were suspected of being allied with the FARC or the ELN, at the same time he was doing that...
For FARC and ELN were guerrilla groups.
Those are the long-standing left-wing guerrilla movements in Colombia. At the same time he was basically funding their opposition, he would employ, you know, populist rhetoric to gain support from poor people in Medellin, positioning himself as the enemy of the establishment and of someone who, you know, wanted to change Colombian society to benefit everyone. So he played both sides of the line with very little conscience, I think.
If you're just joining us, my guest is journalist Mark Bowden. He's the author of the bestseller Black Hawk Down about the U.S. mission in Somalia. His new book, Killing Pablo, is about Colombia cocaine cartel kingpin Pablo Escobar. Let's take a short break here, and then we'll talk some more. This is Fresh Air. Journalist Mark Bowden is my guest. His new book, Killing Pablo, is about Colombian cocaine cartel kingpin Pablo Escobar. How did the U.S. decide to go after Pablo Escobar?
Well, the United States had an interest in going after Escobar that dated back to 1986 or 1987, just as part of the effort to crack down on cocaine being shipped to the United States. When George Bush was elected president, the emphasis in the drug war, which had really escalated during the Reagan years, shifted to what they called the kingpin strategy. They had had so little success interdicting drugs that were being shipped into the country. The idea was to go after the people who were really running these organizations. So it was really during the period of the late 1980s, during the Bush administration, 88, 89, 90, 91, that the United States became militarily involved in tracking down or helping the Colombians to track down these kingpins. And one of the things that they did was lean on the Colombian government to get them to extradite these leaders like Carlos Lederer, for instance, to the United States to stand trial, where some of them are still in prison today. The hunt for Escobar really heated up in 1989 when he bombed a commercial airliner, shot down an airliner. He didn't shoot it down. He had a bomb planted on it that killed 110 people, including two Americans. And this happened about several weeks after the Lockerbie disaster, where the Pan Am flight, I believe it was a Pan Am flight, that was shot down. And so this fear of terrorists attacking commercial airliners was one that alerted the whole international community against Pablo Escobar. He became at that point not just a drug problem. He was then a terrorist problem. And that's when the gears really shifted and he became someone who was considered to be a threat to national security and to the lives of American citizens. And he became then a very, I think, moved really to the top of the list of the people who the United States government would like to either arrest or kill.
One of Pablo Escobar's greatest fears was that he would be extradited to the United States and have to stand trial here and then be imprisoned here. Why was he so worried about being extradited?
He had the government of Colombia under control. He knew that as long as he stayed in Colombia, he could continue to shape his future in the way that he wanted it to be. He knew that if he got extradited to the United States, he would lose that power. And his fear was that he would end up in a position where he could be put in prison and he wouldn't be able to see his family. And that would destroy all of his dreams. His dream, as I understand it, was to be a well-respected, beloved figure in Colombia. You know, a don, you know, the patriarch of his family, you know, wealthy beyond measure. I mean, this was the dream that Pablo Escobar had. Being removed from Colombia destroyed all that. He was no one anymore. I mean, he was a kid who grew up in the suburbs of Medellin, and he never really had cosmopolitan ambitions. You know, his desire was to be the favorite son of Colombia. So for him, extradition, at one point he said he would rather a tomb in Colombia than a jail cell in the United States, and I think he really meant that.
There was even a movement of people called the extraditables in Colombia during this period. What were some of the things that they did to try to influence government leaders in Colombia to try to overturn the agreement with America that they would extradite cocaine criminals?
Well, the extraditables was basically Pablo Escobar. And there were other targets, the United States targets there, like Gacha and Lederer and others who sympathized, I think, with what Escobar was trying to do. But the extraditables did everything from kill people who were active in the effort to track them down and extradite them. Any judge or journalist who spoke out in favor of extradition would be killed. And they were also they also mounted a very skillful public relations campaign. Because when you think about it, extradition is kind of an insult to a country. It's saying you lack the resources, you lack the will, you lack the power to control crime or to arrest this person or bring this person to justice. And so you have to rely on the United States to make those things happen. And it was kind of an insult to national pride. And it was also because Pablo knew that he was a popular figure in Colombia, the idea that the United States could come down and lean on the Colombian government and get them to arrest him and then ship him north to be put in an American prison cell was something that just didn't sit well with the Colombian people. So he had both the intimidation factor going and a legitimate popular disaffection with the idea of extradition. And he worked both of those things very skillfully. In fact, eventually was able to get the government of Colombia to outlaw extradition, to write it into the Constitution that extradition, you know, would not happen in Colombia.
As you said, when he was in Colombia, he had it made no matter what they were doing to him. He was in prison for a while. What was the prison like that Pablo Escobar was in?
Pablo's imprisonment was probably his most clever escape. And I refer to it in the book as it's the end, really, of the first war. The first war being when the Bush administration sent this surveillance unit called Centrospike, which was the most sophisticated radio location unit in the American military. And what that means is that they could listen to a telephone call or a radio call and tell exactly where it came from, I mean, down to within a few hundred yards. So they were able to, with great accuracy and efficiency, to steer these Colombian police forces to the targets of their investigations. So by 1991, Pablo Escobar was on the run. I mean, a man who had, you know, 40 different palatial residences in Colombia alone was sleeping on straw mattresses in the forest, running from location to location because he had to stay one step ahead of the people who were after him. So what he did was he made a deal. He agreed with the Colombian government that he would basically stop blowing things and people up because at the same time he was running, he was setting off car bombs in Bogota and killing scores of people and targeting political figures. And he basically had the country terrified. So he came to Cesar Gaviria, the president of Colombia, and basically made a deal. This is the deal that, for those who have read Gabriel Garcia Marquez's wonderful book, News of a Kidnapping, he details that particular period where Pablo, one of the things that Pablo did was he went out and kidnapped the sons and daughters of 10 very prominent families in Bogota. And only, I think, 7 of the 10 were ultimately released. 3 of them were killed. But this was a very shrewd stab right into the heart of the sort of social political establishment in Bogota. And so he held this sort of wrenching fear over the heads of politicians like Cesar Gaviria, who had been the target of that bomb on the airliner but had escaped because he hadn't gotten on that plane, had escaped death. He agreed that for an end to the violence, they would let Pablo build his own prison. And he would, the only other inmates in the prison would be his associates. And so, and the guards in the prison effectively were his employees. And the wonderful part about this deal, which I love the most, is that his nemesis, the Colombian National Police, were not allowed within 20 kilometers of the prison. So effectively, he set himself up in what was really a resort on a mountaintop, overlooking beautiful view, overlooking his home city, where he was safe from any kind of legal persecution. He was dug in and protected in the event that anyone tried to, any of his enemies tried to come in after him, and where he could reconsolidate his cocaine business and run it undisturbed.
Mark Bowden is the author of Killing Pablo. He'll be back in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and from Wilmington Trust, a wealth management company providing investment and trust services to individuals, families, and corporations nationwide for nearly 100 years. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, Pulling the Trigger, the story of how Pablo Escobar was finally killed. We continue our conversation with journalist Mark Bowden, author of Killing Pablo. And Maureen Corrigan reviews a new collection of interviews with women from New Mexico conducted during the Depression.
Thank you.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with Mark Bowden, author of the new book, Killing Pablo. It's the story of Pablo Escobar, who was the head of Colombia's Medellin cocaine cartel. When we left off, Bowden was describing how Escobar surrendered to Colombian authorities in 1991 after Colombia outlawed extradition and he no longer had to worry about being tried and imprisoned in the U.S. But his surrender was on the condition that Colombia build a special prison for him that was more like a resort. I asked Bowden if the violence stopped while Escobar was in his so-called prison.
The political violence stopped when he surrendered. He was good to his word. He was targeting the political leadership in Colombia, trying to force the country into outlawing extradition and surrendering to him, basically. And so when they made this deal, all that violence stopped. Did Pablo Escobar become a peace-loving man at that point? No way, because violence was part and parcel of his cocaine business. But he always saw the violence that he exacted as a criminal leader, as a cartel leader, to be of no interest to society at large. I mean, that was just a cost of doing business in the world he was in, and he was surprised when the government of Colombia reacted angrily to discover that he'd been executing people within his own prison. These were only his business enemies or people who he felt had betrayed him.
When Colombia agreed with Pablo Escobar and made extradition to the United States illegal, did the U.S. then decide to try assassination since extradition was no longer an option?
In effect, the United States eventually decided to go the assassination route, I think, although certainly no one ever spelled it out in writing. When Escobar surrendered, the United States was outraged, and they pressured the Colombian government not to allow this to happen. The United States was still listening to Pablo Escobar. They knew what was going on inside that prison, and so there was a constant pressure on Cesar Gaviria, the president of the country, to put Pablo Escobar in a real jail, or, you know, but I guess they couldn't do anything other than that. He couldn't extradite him at that point. The biggest favor Pablo did for the United States was walk out of prison, because when Cesar Gaviria was embarrassed after it was discovered that Escobar had been executing people inside the prison and made the decision to at least move him to a real jail, at that point Escobar said, well, then the deal is off, you know, and I'm out of here. Well, the minute he walked out of jail, that gave the United States the opportunity it was looking for. And in fact, President Gaviria asked the United States for any help it could give to finding Escobar. And at that point, I think everyone spoke in euphemisms from that day forward, because they would talk about finding Escobar, you know, arresting Escobar, but nobody wanted to arrest Escobar anymore because they knew that trying to put him in jail would not work. Really, he had painted himself into a corner where the only thing that the civilized world could do with him was kill him.
So what were the intelligence agencies in the United States doing to try to locate Pablo Escobar, and which agencies were most involved?
Well, it was a whole alphabet soup. One of the things that happened at the same time in 1991 was the collapse of the Soviet Union, and this whole, you know, military and espionage establishment, which for half a century had existed to spy on the Eastern Bloc and contain communism, was suddenly jobless for the most part. So here was an opportunity to show that they could be useful in attacking this new kind of problem, which was a terrorist, a person who was considered to be a real danger to the United States, but had to be found in his home country, you know, moving from place to place, knowing he was being watched. So the FBI was involved, the NSA, the CIA, the secret units of the Army, special operations units from the Army, the Navy, the Marine Corps, the State Department's counterterrorism people, alcohol, tobacco, and firearms. At one point, there were so many American units and agencies involved that they were in Colombia at the same time. They were literally tripping over one another. There was very nearly a collision of two planes over Medellin one night where there were so many spy planes in the air. So Ambassador Morris Busby, who was then the U.S. ambassador to Colombia, effectively ordered everybody out of the country except for the CIA, the DEA, and this army unit called Centrospike and Delta Force, the special operations unit from the United States Army.
Now, the assassination of a foreign citizen or even participation or assistance in the assassination of a foreign citizen is illegal in the United States. It's against the law. So what did the United States intelligence agencies do while going about trying to find and help in the execution of Pablo Escobar? How did they do it while at the same time trying to circumvent this law that made that illegal?
It turns out that it isn't against the law for agents of the United States government to kill foreign citizens. It's not a law that prohibits it. It's a presidential order. It's presidential order 12333, and it says very explicitly, no American agency shall assassinate a foreign citizen or shall be involved with anyone assassinating foreign citizens. And this was an order that was issued back in during the Ford administration at a time when there was a tremendous amount of concern over the abuses of the spy agencies, the FBI and the CIA, during the Kennedy and Nixon eras. And so I think most people believe that that's really the guiding principle in American foreign policy. But in fact, what I discovered in working on killing Pablo was that when George Bush Sr. took office in 1988, he had a man named Hayes Parks, who was the chief legal counsel for the Pentagon, write a memorandum of law interpreting that prohibition to mean not that foreign citizens couldn't be assassinated, but they could be assassinated if the target was deemed to be a clear and present danger to national security or a threat to American citizens. And here's where the bombing of the airliner comes in. When Pablo Escobar was responsible for downing a commercial airliner, there were two American citizens on board. It showed that he had the capability and the will and the to kill American citizens, and that gave the United States the justification it needed to go down there and basically track him down and kill him. They didn't do that, at least so far as I was able to tell, directly. They did it by proxy, by helping the Colombians to create a unit that had the capability to move quickly, to find targets, to move on them and kill them. But, the United States had radio location teams down there helping them find these people. They had Delta Force operators who were training and in some cases leading the Colombian units. So it was done kind of in a collaborative effort with the Colombians. And it was never announced that it was their intention to kill either Escobar or any of the other people around him who kept turning up dead. It was always explained as this person was killed in a gun battle with the Colombian police.
So how was Escobar finally killed?
Escobar was increasingly isolated as the months went by. When they learned that it was going to be virtually impossible for them to catch up to him personally, because he had such a network of supporters family and friends in Medellin, he was like a man who was standing on top of a mountain. And ideally, when you fantasize, you would be able to just go pluck him off of the top of that mountain. But what the search groups realized was that they couldn't do that. He was too well protected. So the only way to get him was to tear down the mountain. And so they began in early 1993 tracking down and killing anyone who was associated with Escobar, his lawyers, his bankers, his people who were business partners, family members, extended family members, anybody who Escobar relied upon, to sort of stay at large and to continue to function, was now running for their lives. And so you had all of his members of his extended family fleeing Colombia, desperately trying to find safe haven. Well, what this boiled down to ultimately was the fear that Escobar had for his wife and his two children, who were holed up, basically held prisoner in a apartment complex in Medellin that itself was bombed several times. People would shoot rocket grenades at it as little reminders to him that his family was vulnerable. And so it ended up in late 1993, Escobar was isolated and on the run and very much afraid for the safety of his family. So he kept calling them. He had to keep in touch with his son, Juan Pablo, and they would talk you know, whenever it was possible and they felt it was safe, they would speak just about every day in the afternoon because Pablo was plotting with them, trying to help get them out of the country. And this ultimately is what enabled the search forces to find him, because he kept popping up on the airwaves, and every time he came up on the airwaves, they had the capability of determining where he was.
So who are the guys who actually pulled the trigger?
Well, I believe the people who actually killed Escobar were members of the Colombian Bloque de Búsqueda, which means search block, which was this elite unit that had been created under the leadership of Colonel Hugo Martinez, and who had spent very nearly 2 years tracking down Escobar and sort of systematically taking apart his organization. You know, Escobar, the standard account is that Escobar was killed when he came running out on a rooftop in Medellin and exchanged gunfire with the forces who had found him and who were there waiting for him. In fact, you know, I found when I looked into it that Escobar was killed with a gunshot wound to his right ear, which was a hell of a good piece of shooting for, you know, people who were shooting at him from 200 feet away. I think what more likely happened is that Escobar tried to escape, as he always had, by climbing out a back window and running across this rooftop where, you know, there were these men waiting for him. He was shot down. He was hit once in the leg, once in the back, not wounds that would have killed him, but enough to knock him down. And then I think someone, you know, from that group probably walked up and just summarily executed him.
My guest is Mark Bowden, author of Killing Pablo, the story of Pablo Escobar. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Mark Bowden, and his new book, Killing Pablo, is about Pablo Escobar, who was the head of the Medellin cocaine cartel. So Pablo Escobar was killed. His cartel was decimated. Did it decrease the flow of cocaine from Colombia?
No. Pablo Escobar's death had no impact at all on the flow of cocaine to the United States, because what happened during this whole period that the Medellin cartel was being disassembled is that the Cali cartel, which was always the Medellin cartel's rival, picked up the slack. And not only did they pick up the slack, they contributed to the hunt for Pablo Escobar. You know, they contributed money. Even to this day, there are allegations that very high-ranking police and politicians in Colombia accepted huge amounts of money as rewards for their efforts to track down and kill Pablo Escobar. Once the Medellin cartel was gone and Pablo was dead, the efforts of the United States and the Colombian government then turned to the Cali cartel, which itself was crushed over the next 4 or 5 years. But then crushing the Cali cartel succeeded only in pushing the processing, distribution, and trafficking of drugs into the hands of the guerrillas, the FARC and the ELN, where it resides today. So the ultimate consequence of killing Escobar and of taking apart the Cali cartel was to hand the drug business over to the left-wing guerrillas, who have now used it to build, you know, huge fortunes and arsenals and build enough of a rebellion in that country so that the government is in real danger.
So the left-wing insurgents have used money from cocaine sales to fuel their movement.
Exactly. You know, the FARC...
It seems really... counterintuitive in a way and against their politics.
Yeah, well, I think that the idealistic view of a left-wing guerrilla movement is that it has the interests of the people at heart and social justice, and the rhetoric of the FARC and the ELN certainly would lead you to believe that. But these are movements that have been off in the hills for 40 and 50 years in Colombia, and, you know, they've evolved with the times, and they've been corrupted, in my opinion, by the availability of all this money. They have never been able to make big inroads and gain a tremendous amount of popular support, certainly not in the cities. And in Colombia, the government is basically city-states. I mean, the countryside is still mountains or jungles, and the government or civilization exists primarily in the urban centers. And the guerrillas have never been able in Colombia to penetrate those urban centers because they don't have a lot of popular support. In the mountains and in the jungles, they've always managed to survive, in part because Colombia is such a great place to hide. You know, it's just a untamed, one of the few really untrammeled places left in the world. So what the cocaine money meant was that these sort of anemic guerrilla movements suddenly had huge resources to go out and buy weapons, to recruit people, to train soldiers, to pay their, you know, guerrilla soldiers. And that was a huge shot in the arm. And so they're now, I believe, you know, they subsist primarily because they have access to all this drug money, and they claim they're just protecting the drug trade. But in fact, I believe that they effectively run the drug business.
Your new book is about Pablo Escobar. Your previous book was about was called Black Hawk Down. It was a bestseller about the American mission in Somalia. Pablo Escobar's murder and the American mission in Somalia were the same year, 1993. Are there any other links in those two stories besides the chronological one?
The connection between the two books is that some of the same units and people were involved, at least on the American side. When I began working on the story of Black Hawk Down, I was just interested in this battle that had happened in Mogadishu. But the research put me in touch with men who are part of the special operations community in the American military. And these are men who lead very quiet, kind of clandestine lives, because their missions are generally classified and we very often don't ever hear about them. And it was in the course of reporting Black Hawk Down that I was in the office of a military officer who had been one of the commanders in Mogadishu, Somalia. And he had this picture on his wall of a bloody, dead, fat man with a bunch of men with rifles posing around him. And I asked him, you know, "General, I'm sorry, you have to tell me what that is. I mean, it was a perfectly horrible image." And he said, "That, my friend, is Pablo Escobar. I keep that on my wall to remind me that no matter how rich you get in this life, you can still be too big for your britches." And I just remember writing down on my notepad, remember, this is when I was still working on Black Hawk Down, I wrote Pablo Escobar on my notepad and underlined it about five times. And then when I finished the story of the Battle of Mogadishu, I immediately started working on the story in Colombia. And it was somewhat easier for me to get a handle on it because I had already met some of the people who were in the Battle of Mogadishu were also Delta Force operatives who had worked in Colombia on this hunt for Pablo Escobar. And interestingly, you know, Centrospike, this unit which finds people, it's the Army's radio location unit, and they can listen to a radio signal or a telephone signal and find its location very, very accurately. They were at work both in Mogadishu and in Colombia. But in Mogadishu, it was American forces who were going out. So they would target the lieutenants or the people around Mohammed Farah Aidid, who was the target in Somalia. But they would arrest them. They would launch these missions, these raids, and they would arrest them and take them out to this little island off the coast of Kismayo and keep them there. In Colombia, when they found people, they killed them. Not necessarily the American soldiers, but you know, the Colombian search bloc that went after them killed them. So in many ways, you know, what they were doing in Somalia was exactly the same thing they were doing in Colombia, only it had much, you know, murkier, darker consequences in Colombia, in part because of the nature of that country and in part because of the nature of the of our involvement with them and the drug business.
Well, Mark Bowden, thank you so much for talking with us.
You're welcome. It's a pleasure.
Mark Bowden is the author of Killing Pablo, about Pablo Escobar. He's been a reporter for the Philadelphia Inquirer for over 20 years.
Thank you.
Coming up, Maureen Corrigan reviews a new book of Depression-era interviews that's a product of the Federal Writers Project. This is Fresh Air. During the Great Depression, President Franklin Roosevelt instituted the Federal Writers Project, which, among other tasks, sent unemployed writers to work, compiling material for a series of states' guides. That enormous federally funded research project is apparently still paying off. Book critic Maureen Corrigan has a review of a newly published collection of interviews called Women's Tales from the New Mexico WPA.
The Hispanic women who Lou Sage Batchin and Annette Hesh Thorpe interviewed during the Great Depression called them La Diabla a Pie. That's a bilingual pun which literally translates as the devil on foot, but which also refers to the agency that sent the two white women, the WPA. During the 1930s, Franklin Roosevelt's Works Projects Administration hired hundreds of writers to work on a series of states' guides. Their job was to gather and write up bits of folklore and other anthropological material to add to the local color of the books. Batchin and Thorpe worked on the WPA Guide to New Mexico, setting out, sometimes with interpreters, by car. The two women traveled separately to remote villages to collect stories, cuentos, from the elderly Hispanic women who were the caretakers of their community's pasts. Batchin and Thorpe were older women themselves, so maybe they struck up some kind of transcultural sisterly rapport with their subjects. Then again, that appellation, the devil on foot, indicates the WPA workers were viewed with some cynicism. After all, they were outsiders, harbingers of the end of the isolation that had long kept these little New Mexican towns culturally intact. Batchin and Thorpe filed hundreds of pages of interviews in the late 1930s and early 40s. Until recently, those pages sat moldering in manila envelopes in the New Mexico History Library in Santa Fe. Then, a few years ago, another pair of nosy women, Tay Diana Rebolledo and Maria Teresa Marquez, both academics, began sifting through the interviews. The result is a collection called Women's Tales from the New Mexico WPA. These tales aren't elegant in any literary sense. After all, they're translated transcriptions of oral recollections. But read in their entirety, their effect is profound. The stories provide a soft-focused look at a rough way of life, where women's work was unremitting, where even parties and funerals were the occasions for heavy labor, like making molasses or gutting a pig, and where having a brightly colored tilma or cloth in your home was a big deal, because that typical two-room shack, as Lou Sage Batchin reports, would otherwise have so little in it that was not purely essential. No wonder most elegies about the vanished frontier have been written by men. The women folk were probably too busy, as the women interviewed here were, mixing mud and straw to plaster walls, cooking meals in a fireplace, planting onions and tobacco, sewing, scrubbing clothes, and birthing babies. Apart from the accounts of domestic life, many of the old wives' tales that Batchin and Thorpe gathered seem to have been designed to keep adolescent girls in line. Annette Hesh Thorpe set down a popular cautionary tale called Satan and the Girl, told to her in 1941 by a woman in her late 70s named Juliana Martinez. In it, a young girl slips out of her house one night to go walking with her sweetheart, No sooner are they alone than the boy reveals he's really Satan. Chains begin to rattle and fireballs appear. Here's how the tale ends. The girl fainted, and when she revived, found herself on a great mesa, so far from home that it took her 4 days to walk back. After that, she was ill for more than a year. She was shunned by all the village people, and no young man would marry her. After her grandmother died, she lived alone for the rest of her life. That tale's message of don't talk to boys couldn't be clearer. Editors Rebolledo and Marquez remark, however, that other fanciful yarns collected here seem to be slyly resistant. Certainly the many stories about curanderas, doctors who were always middle-aged or old women, and brujas, or witches, celebrate female power, sometimes purchased at the cost of a woman's soul. Reading this volume of women's tales from the New Mexico WPA, I couldn't help but marvel, not only at the everyday details of an extinct world, but also at an extinct political impulse that would subsidize a federal program just to gather ordinary people's stories. Stories that, like those homespun tilmas, have always been essential to people's lives.
Maureen Corrigan teaches literature at Georgetown University. She reviewed Women's Tales from the New Mexico WPA, published by Art Publico Press. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our interviews and reviews are produced by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, and Monique Nazareth, with Anne-Marie Baldonado, Megan Howell, Patty Leswing, and Jessica Chu. Roberta Shurrock directs the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Desde muy lejos mis sueños de oro se han agitado dentro de mi alma. Por una imagen que yo persigo, por una imagen siempre adorada. Y en vano busco por todas partes aquella imagen.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Barnes & Noble Booksellers and the Discover Great New Writers Program, which features the literary voices of tomorrow today. Information available at Barnes & Noble stores and on the web at www.bn.com. From the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. From the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, promoting excellence in journalism worldwide and investing in the vitality of 26 U.S. communities. And from Random House Incorporated's Delacorte Press Division, publisher of Far Appalachia, Following the New River North by Noah Adams. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, actress Laura Linney. She received an Oscar nomination for her starring role in You Can Count on Me. She's now starring in Armistead Maupin's Further Tales of the City, which begins Sunday on Showtime. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.